She shook her head. Uh-uh. She's not home. Do you know where she went?
She went to college,
JoJo said, still smiling. My heart sank.
She left already?
Who are the flowers for? I looked at the bouquet, and for a moment, I didn't say or do anything. Then I plucked the card from the plastic stem and handed the flowers to Joanna. They're for you, I said. She took them, either too startled to speak or worried I might be joking. I turned and walked down the steps.
Sam!
When I turned back, Joanna stood on the top step, holding the flowers just beneath her chin. She looked like an angel.
Thanks for the flowers, Sam.
29. I didn't hear from Mickey, but I thought of her every day and occasionally contemplated calling her mother to get her dorm number or driving to Davis and surprising her. But each time I found a reason not to go. I was grateful to be so busy. Each morning my mother and I ate breakfast together. Then I drove to the store and she drove off to be with my dad and participate in his continued rehabilitation. Eventually, she would go with me to the store so I could begin training her to take my job. I'm not sure she would have done it for anything less important than getting me to college. In November, we decorated the store in anticipation of Thanksgiving. The holiday would mean several days off school for Ernie and for Mickey, and I wondered if either would come home. Ernie had a football game that weekend, and he and his parents had traveled back to Indiana for a game against Notre Dame, followed by Thanksgiving with the rest of the team. The day before Thanksgiving, I answered a knock at the door, and there Mickey stood. She looked thinner than when she left, and her hair was longer, nearly touching her shoulders.
Hey, Hill, how's it going?
She walked past me and plopped down on the sofa.
It's going good, I said. How's college?
The dorm food sucks. Most of the kids are neurotic, and my chemistry teacher is a lecher. I'm about to kick him in the nuts. Can I get a glass of water?
She made her way into the kitchen and pulled a glass from the cabinet, filling it at the sink, not far from where we'd had the war of peas and fallen to the floor to make love.
I have soda, I said.
Throw it out.
We did this experiment where you put a piece of meat in the soda and it eats the flesh.
So you gave up soda?
And red meat. My roommate's a vegan, but I'm not going there. She doesn't shave her legs or her armpits either.
Please don't go there, I said.
Your mom home?
She's at the store.
She's working?
One afternoon a week to give me a break.
How long are you home?
Sunday. You get me for 4 days, Hill.
Let's catch a matinee.
You're buying. I'm a poor college kid now, and you're a rich business mogul.
Hardly.
She stepped forward and gave me a hug. And for an instant, I thought she might kiss me. Then she pulled back and was again on the move.
All right, Hill. Daylight's burning, and I want to stop at the store and say hello to your mother and use my discount to get some candy. I'm still family, right?
I don't know, I said. The store is under new management, you know, and I hear the new boss is a real hard ass. She laughed and pulled me by the hand out the door. We did not talk about what happened the night of the Last Supper, but I did not feel like a notch on Mickey's bedpost as I had with Donna. Over the course of the fall months, I'd had a lot of time to think about Mickey and to consider what had happened that night. I knew Mickey loved me, or at least that's what I told myself. And I told myself that she'd fled that night because she had felt something with me that she had never felt with any of the others, and it had scared her. Mickey didn't want to be in love, burdened by the terrible lessons her parents had taught her. She didn't want the pain. Her knocking on our door that Thanksgiving was Mickey's way of telling me she loved me. It wasn't enough, not for me, but I was certain it was also all I would ever get out of Mickey. 30. The following fall, just before the start of my freshman year at Stanford, I drove to the Palo Alto Eye Clinic to see Dr. Pridemore.
What can I do for you? He asked.
My annual visit was not for several months.
I had given God so many chances to show me his way. I felt betrayed, and never as much as when he failed to answer my prayers that he spare my father the debilitating effects of his stroke. If he would not do that, I knew he would not change the color of my eyes, as I had so fervently prayed when I was just a young boy. I knew now that only science could do that. God's will is not our way, my mother used to say, and I agreed. I had decided it was not my way. I'm ready, I said. I'd like to try those brown contact lenses. Part 6. Hello, darkness, my old friend. 1. 1989, Burlingame, California. With more and more damage caused by the earthquake being revealed by newscasters on Ernie's television, I finally got through to my mother's telephone. She was relieved to hear my voice and to know I was okay. I'm fine, she said. The house is fine. Some of Grandma O'Malley's spode china tumbled off the display shelf and broke. Nothing that can't be replaced. I rattled off a series of questions. Do you smell any gas? Did you check the pilot light on the water heater? Do you have bottled water? I'm fine, Sam, she reassured me. Stop worrying. Have you reached the rehabilitation facility? I asked. How's Dad? My father never recovered from his stroke, which the doctor said had also triggered the early onset of dementia. He became confused easily, especially if there was a break in his daily routine. He's fine, she said. The facility didn't suffer any damage. Do you want me to come by and help you clean up? I asked. Don't think about it. It isn't much. Besides, I'm heading up to see your father. I want to be with him. My father couldn't do much in a wheelchair, but my mother had told me before that she didn't care. They sat together holding hands. Sometimes, she would place a rosary in his fingers and help him move from bead to bead while she prayed aloud. There's no place else I'd rather be, she'd say. I'll call you later, probably tomorrow, I said. I hung up, thinking of that night when I'd learned of my father's stroke, and the recollection made me realize again how precious life is and how fragile. 1 minute, you're celebrating graduation, and the next, your father is near death. 1 minute, you're getting ready to experience a World Series. The next, you could be dead under a pile of concrete. Too short. Life was too short to settle for anything less than the love I had witnessed when Ernie pulled into his driveway. The love I had witnessed my entire life. The love, Mickey said, I deserved. Damn her. She was always right. Life was too short to settle for Eva. A part of me had always known that I'd stayed in the relationship longer than I should have because I lacked the confidence to believe I'd find someone else who would accept me and my condition. I was also smart enough to know that would never happen until I fully accepted me. When I started to wear contact lenses, I put up a bland, brown veil of normalcy, not only to the rest of the world, but to the person on the other side of the mirror. I no longer had to concern myself with the lingering stares or questions. I no longer had to deal with my condition. I no longer had to come to terms with who I was, as my mother had said would be so important when I was just a boy heading off to grade school. I hadn't dealt with the issue. I'd simply covered it up, literally and figuratively. Mickey's wanting me to tell Eva that I deserved to be treated better, that she was not good enough for me, had nothing to do with Eva. It had to do with me. Mickey recognized it was an opportunity for me to begin not just the process of accepting who I was, but liking that person. As I sat with the Cantwells watching the television, the news became more and more sobering with each passing minute. Initial reports indicated cars had plummeted from the bridge into the San Francisco Bay. Others hung over the abyss. Reports from the East Bay were just as disturbing. The 880 interchange, a double-decker concrete freeway, had collapsed. It could not have come at a worse time, filled with afternoon commuters. Dozens were said to be trapped beneath the rubble. People had died. The Embarcadero Freeway along the San Francisco waterfront had also suffered major structural damage. People had pitched tents on the lawn in the Marina District, afraid to go back to their homes and apartments because of a series of aftershocks. Michelle made pasta and a salad, but none of us ate much. I called home. Eva did not answer. Her flight had been scheduled to land at the Oakland airport just after 4 p.m., which would have put her right in the heart of all the traffic. I would likely go home and find a message on the answering machine telling me she decided to stay in a hotel in the East Bay to avoid the mess. Terrific. She and Mr. Sleepy could hold each other through the trauma. At 9 o'clock, I made another call and again got my answering machine. I hung up and told Ernie, I'm going to head home. Did you reach her? Ernie asked. I shook my head. She's probably staying at a hotel in Oakland rather than fight the traffic. 2. When I pulled up to my two-story house with the cedar shake siding, I noticed the porch light was on, as well as another light in the front living room, and was certain Eva was home. I'd given this moment some thought about what I would say. I decided to wait and let Eva speak, give her the chance to at least be honest with me. If she was, I'd tell her thanks, but it was time she moved out. If she wasn't, well, then, at least I knew who she truly was, and again, I'd ask her to move out. When I looked to the upstairs windows, I did not see a light on in the bedroom. Eva's car was not parked in the driveway. Strange. When I climbed the front steps to the covered porch, I heard a familiar bark. When I tried to open the door, Bandit pushed his bony head between the door and the jamb, whining and whimpering with excitement. Okay, okay, Bandit. Back up, buddy. Back up. I stepped in and looked about the room while squatting to pet Bandit and scratch his sides. I didn't see any suitcases. Bandit's tail whipped the air. Mickey? I called out. Eva? No one answered. I saw a slip of paper on the tile counter beside the answering machine. Thought you might need some company. M. Mickey, checking up on me. The blinking red light on the answering machine drew my finger toward the button, but I changed my direction to the pantry. You hungry, Bandit? His tail whipped vigorously. When Mickey traveled, I watched her boys, which was what she called her dogs. I kept a bag of dog food in the pantry. Eva did not like pets. She reacted to any piece of dog hair on her clothing as if it was radioactive. I wondered if she'd come home, but left when she encountered Bandit. But there was no sign she'd been in the house. Bandit's whimpering became more pronounced at the sight of the food bag. I filled his metal bowl and barely got it to the floor before he dunked his huge jowls and began crunching. I filled a second bowl with water and set it out of harm's way. Bandit tended to slide his bowl all over my tile floor, seeking every nugget. As I watched the big dog eat, I sensed the red light blinking behind me. When he'd finished, Bandit looked up at me with his dark, expectant eyes. Sorry, buddy. Mickey says one bowl. You're getting too fat. The skin above his eyes wrinkled in disappointment. I know. Women, right? I opened the back door to the yard. Okay. Time for both of us to take care of our business. Bandit bounded out. I left the door open so he could get back in and made my way to the answering machine. When I hit the button, a computerized voice indicated there had been a power failure. Then the machine retrieved the stored messages. The first message was left at 4:12 p.m., before the earthquake. Eva. Hey, Sam. Just wanted to let you know that my flight landed, and I'm on my way home. Looking forward to seeing you. I didn't have a lot of time to react or analyze the message because the machine beeped and the second message began playing. Mickey. Hey, it's me. I know you went to the game with Ernie, but I saw that it got canceled and I'm checking up on you. I left Bandit at the house to keep you company. I hope you're all right. I'm fine. Couple of cracks in my plaster in the living room, but otherwise, no damage. Okay, I'm rambling. Call me and let me know you're okay. Love you. The machine beeped a third time. I awaited the next message, the one from Eva calling to tell me that traffic was a bitch and she decided to spend the night at a hotel in the East Bay, but there was no voice, just a hang-up. The stilted, computerized voice indicated no further messages. I was about to walk off when the phone rang. Isn't it always like that? Your ears must have been burning. Or, I was just thinking of you. I took a deep breath, cleared my throat, and answered. Hello? Sam? Eva? No, Sam. I'm sorry. This is Meredith? Eva's mother. Meredith? It dawned on me that she would be worried. They lived in Southern California and had obviously heard the news about the earthquake. I'm sorry, I wasn't... Listen, Eva called and left a message that her flight landed. I'm sure she's in a hotel somewhere because the roads are a mess here, as you can imagine. The phone lines have been down. Eva's not in a hotel, Sam. Did she call you? Meredith was weeping. She could not continue. I heard someone take the phone. Sam? Eva's father, Gary Pryor. We got a call, Sam. He paused. He, too, was fighting tears. They found Eva's car, Sam. They found it underneath the freeway. 3. Gary Pryor told me he would catch a plane to San Francisco in the morning and asked that I pick him up at the airport. He said someone needed to identify Eva's body. I wrote his flight information on the back of Mickey's note because I knew I would not remember any of our conversation. Then I hung up and stumbled to the couch. Bandit's paws clicked on the tile floor as he trotted in from the backyard, but he did not jump onto the couch or force his head into my hands to be petted. Sensing a mood change, he lowered his head and padded forward, his tail silent. When he got close, he stopped again, waiting for some sign. Did I want his comfort? I opened my palm, and Bandit stepped forward and rested his head in my lap, looking up at me with a furrowed brow and sad eyes. I lowered my forehead to the bony knob atop his head. I wanted to cry, but I also could not stop a thought swirling in my head. I stood, startling Bandit, who jumped backwards, wary. I paced the living room and I tried to fill my head with any thought to avoid the one that kept circulating. Eva's father was coming. He was going to identify her body and fly her ashes back to Los Angeles for a funeral service. Her father was coming. Her father. I stopped pacing. I remembered Ernie's two boys racing from their front door to embrace their daddy, gripping his legs. This was Gary Pryor's baby girl. This was something no father should have to do. No, I said aloud. No. I found the paper on which I had written the information and called the number. Gary answered on the first ring. I'm going over to the morgue tonight, I said. I'm going to identify Eva. I'll have her body transported to a funeral home here in Burlingame, and I'll ask that she be cremated. We'll fly her ashes home together. Gary did not immediately answer. He sobbed, great gasps and moans that prevented words, but that I understood. He'd been bearing up for his wife, for Eva's sisters, for the entire family. With the details of Eva's remains taken from him, he could mourn his daughter. Thank you, he said. Thank you, Sam. I hung up and called Mickey. Hey, she said, I've been trying to reach you. Are you all right? I thought maybe you went to your mom's, but no one answered. I'm going to bring Bandit back tonight, I said. Keep him. Bandit loves it there. He gets a lot more attention, and you two bachelors deserve each other. Eva's dead, Mickey. I said the words because a part of me needed to hear them to believe them. What? I just got off the phone with her father. The freeway crushed her car. She's dead. I'm on my way, Mickey said. 4. We got back to my house at 1 a.m. Mickey took the key from my hand and inserted it in the lock when I failed the task twice. I sat on the sofa petting Bandit while she opened the liquor cabinet. Going to have to be bourbon, she said. I had drunk all of Eva's scotch.
Do you have anything to mix it with?
Ice, I said. I heard her pull open the freezer and take the tray to the counter, the ice tumbling into a glass. Identifying Eva's body was worse than I anticipated, and I had entered the makeshift morgue anticipating that nothing I would ever do in my life would be worse than this task. I was glad I did it, though. Glad that her father would not have to do it. Glad that the search and rescue team had been able to reach her car and her body. Further reports throughout the night indicated more cars remained trapped beneath the tons of concrete, people still inside, alive. Eva's beautiful face had been spared damage, and that was all the attendee showed me. But as a doctor, I understood from the way the sheet draped her body that much of her torso had been crushed and disfigured, bones broken. She'd likely died instantly. After the attendee had pulled the sheet back over Eva's face, she had moved to a second body lying beside Eva. Are you here to identify the man in the car as well? It had felt like a stab to the heart. Mickey had given me a look, but I did not tell her. No, I said. I'm not. Mickey walked from the kitchen into the family room and handed me my bourbon. She sat close, just as she used to sit when we drove the Falcon. For a long time, we did not speak. I drank my bourbon until only ice remained. Mickey took my glass and poured another drink. I could feel the effects of the alcohol on my already tired body and weakened mental state. I took another sip. Thanks for going with me tonight.
Not something anyone should have to do alone, she said. She took a sip of water. That's a brave thing you did, so her father wouldn't have to.
I blew out a breath. I can't cry, I said.
Why can't I cry? The hell is wrong with me?
There's nothing wrong with you. Do you know what my first thought was when I found out? When her father told me, don't.
Relief.
Sam, don't. I felt relief that I wasn't going to have to confront her, that I didn't have to tell her it was over and that she needed to move out. What kind of a person thinks that way?
A good person.
Nice try.
I'm serious.
A bad person wouldn't be that honest. They wouldn't feel any guilt at all.
A bad person never would have done what you just did.
A bad person would have punted the responsibility and told her family that he wanted nothing to do with any of it. But I know you. And I know that you'll go to your grave and never tell another living soul that she cheated on you. And neither will I. Her parents will bury the daughter they loved and get to keep all the memories.
The tears burst from me with a gasp, like a dam exploding. Now I could not control them, could not stop the flood. I felt Mickey pull me to her and place my head against her chest, stroking my hair, letting me sob. She removed the pillow from behind her and leaned back, holding me, until I could hear my breathing slow, and I drifted off. 5. Everyone at Eva's funeral seemed willing to play their part in a tragedy Shakespearean in its magnitude. The young couple, about to embark on a life together, ripped apart and forever separated by the forces of nature, leaving the future groom to pull together the pieces of his shattered existence. Ernie and Michelle flew down with Mickey and my mother to be with me for Eva's funeral in Redondo Beach, and I was grateful they came. Their presence gave me back my identity and validated my existence beyond the role of the unknown, grieving boyfriend. At the end of the service, I followed Eva's casket out of the church with the rest of her family and watched the hearse depart. They had a town car for the family, but Ernie saved me.
You want a ride to the reception?
I nearly hugged him. The reception was held in the backyard of the Pryor home, a beautiful setting with a view of the Pacific Ocean and a light breeze that brought the smell of the salt air. I parked my mother beneath the shade of a table umbrella with a plate of catered food and a Diet Coke. Mickey and Michelle sat and talked with her while Ernie and I made our way to the bar. I noticed a few people from the church approaching
and mentally steeled myself for their condolences.
Excuse me, one of the men said, but aren't you Ernie Cantwell?
Yes, I am, Ernie said.
We thought so, the man said. We saw you in the church. Can we get an autograph?
As Ernie signed the autographs, the men looked to me and introduced themselves.
How do you know Eva? One of them asked.
Just a friend, I said. Ernie and I picked up our beers and found a corner of the yard.
How are you holding up? Ernie asked.
Like an actor backstage in the green room waiting to go on again. I felt guilty saying it, but it was the truth. What seemed to be either lost on everyone, or at least unspoken, was the irony that we did not know one another. Except for a dinner at a restaurant in San Francisco that I had shared with Eva's parents when they came to visit, I had never eaten with them, never shared the holidays with the family, visited over a weekend, or attended family vacations. I had never even met Eva's sisters.
We've gone through some crazy shit together, but this might be the craziest.
Ernie sipped his beer, surveying the crowd. But I had already begun to realize that there was one more crazy thing I needed to do. 6. The following week, Trina Crouch sat in my office. Mickey had taken Daniela down the street for an ice cream while I recounted my whole sordid confrontation with David Bateman the day I told everyone else that I had fallen off my bike. I told her of the meeting with Father Brogan at the OLM rectory that led to Father Brogan expelling David.
You stood up to him, Crouch said. You got him expelled.
Before our consult, I had removed my brown contact lenses in a sign of good faith.
He got himself expelled.
He said you told the priest, and the priest kicked him out. He said it humiliated his parents. He said his father, he was not a good man either.
I never told the priest, Trina.
You didn't?
She asked, clearly puzzled.
David's two friends ratted him out.
I sat back, considering her. I didn't have the courage to tell anyone, not the priest and not my parents, I said. I didn't think anyone could help me or protect me. I was afraid. Had it not been for the other two boys' consciences bothering them, David would have continued to bully me.
I don't have anyone like that, she said.
You do, I said. You have me, and you have Mickey.
She looked confused. She wiped her tears.
Why?
Because we all need someone.
Can you help Daniela?
I can only repair Daniela's eye, I said. Tears spilled down Trina's cheeks at my unspoken meaning. I rolled my chair to the sofa on which she sat and handed her the box of Kleenex. The retina is the neurosensory tissue that lines the back inside wall of the eye. I used the model of the eyeball and socket I pulled off the shelf. It's sort of like wallpaper on sheetrock, or the film in a camera. The retina transfers the light coming into our eye into vision. The center of the retina is called the macula, and is the only part capable of fine, detailed vision, the vision for reading. The remainder of the retina, the peripheral...
Daniela can't read books anymore. She says everything is blurry.
When the retina detaches, it separates from the back wall. When it separates, it is removed from its blood supply and source of nutrition. The retina will degenerate and lose its ability to function if it remains detached. Daniela will lose her central vision.
She'll go blind.
I sat back. Yes. For all intents and purposes, she'll go blind in that eye. Fortunately, over 90% of retinal detachments can be repaired with a single procedure. There are three different surgical approaches that we can take.
I don't have any insurance, she said. I lost my job 3 months ago.
I placed the model on the desk.
What about your ex-husband?
No, she said, shaking her head. He's a police officer. He must have benefits.
No,
she said more forcefully.
Trina, I can't have any interaction with him, she said, raising her voice like a frightened child.
I gave her a second. She took a deep breath and said,
he took us off his benefits after the divorce.
and I agreed to it because I had a job and I just wanted to be rid of him as much as I could. I spoke softly, gently. He has a responsibility to his daughter. He hates me so much for leaving him, he'll do anything to hurt me, even hurt her. You could force him, in court. She shook her head and smiled, though it had a sad quality to it. It would only make him angry. He'd take it out on me and Daniela, and lawyers cost money, Dr. Hill. So do hospitals and funeral parlors. I don't want to bury my daughter or have her watch him bury me. I don't want to leave her to him. He's a monster.
7. I knew that once I set the wheels in motion, I could not stop or back out. But I wanted to give David Bateman a chance, and Trina ultimately gave me her blessing to talk to him. I still had a difficult time believing there did not exist some spark of decency in the man, that the boy who had terrorized me had done so because his father had terrorized him, that his bullying wasn't all his own doing. The following week, I chose Moon McShane's for a meeting because it felt like home turf, and I knew there would be people inside who knew me. Even still, sitting at a table near the plate glass windows that looked out at peaceful downtown Burlingame, I couldn't dismiss my nerves, which I'm sure were Pavlovian. Bateman parked his patrol car in a red zone, and those nerves intensified. I took several deep breaths as I watched him step out of his car and insert his billy club into his holster. He strode to the door in his uniform, the bulletproof vest beneath his shirt making him look even bigger. When he entered, he nearly filled the doorframe. He rested his hands on the black utility belt, gun prominently displayed. The night he'd assaulted me in the Presbyterian Church parking lot, I had been too startled and intimidated to fully register the size of the man. With nub-short hair, he had become his father. I stood from my seat as he approached the table, garnering looks from nearly everyone in the bar. He wore a shit-eating grin. "Thanks for coming," I said over the sound of a football game. I offered my hand. He ignored it and sat. "I see you're still wearing the contacts. Can I buy you a cup of coffee?" Bateman turned his head to the window, ignoring my offer. I got to the point. "Your daughter needs surgery." He glanced at me. "So?" "She has a detached retina. If she doesn't have it fixed soon, it will degenerate. She could go blind in that eye." He shrugged. "How is this my problem?" "She's your daughter," I said, somewhat disbelieving. "She lives with my ex-wife. Take it up with her." "I already have." Bateman's eyes narrowed. "Yeah? What did she tell you?" "She lost her job. She doesn't have health insurance." He smirked. "Your insurance would cover the cost of her surgery."
"She wants me to pay?"
"It would be the insurance company's money," I said.
"I earn the benefits. What if my rates or my deductible go up?"
I shook my head, not completely believing what I was hearing. It reminded me of when Father Brogan had confronted Bateman in the rectory, and Bateman had expressed no guilt. David Bateman was not just a man who suffered as a child. This was a sociopath, possibly a psychopath.
"Are you for real?" I asked.
Bateman leaned across the table.
"I'll tell you what I am. Grow up," I said.
And the ferocity of my response momentarily startled him into silence. "You're not a 9-year-old boy anymore, and neither am I. So knock off the big bad wolf bullshit. Your daughter is going blind, and we both know it came at your hand. Your ex-wife didn't tell me. I figured it out on my own. So did the emergency room doctor. But I'm willing to let that go, David. I'm willing to cut you some slack and give you the chance to do the right thing, something decent." Bateman stood, palms flat on the table.
"You want me to do something decent? You tell her to do something decent. You tell her that when she comes home, I'll think about paying the bills. Otherwise, they're on their own. Just as she wanted it."
8.
I scheduled Daniela's surgery 3 weeks after my consult with Trina Crouch on a Thursday morning. When I entered the surgical room, I felt nervous. I usually had some nerves before surgery, but my nerves that morning were more pronounced. I knew in a way that I was Daniela's Pastor Brogan. I was the person fate had destined to protect her from the bully. The irony was she and I shared the same bully. In some ways, I saw myself in Daniela, and this was my way of standing up to David Bateman. "How's she doing?" I asked the anesthesiologist.
"She's doing great. Everything looks good."
"You ready?" I asked my erstwhile surgical assistant for that day.
"Let's save an eyeball," Mickey said.
We were lucky. We did not need to remove the lens, and there was minimal scar tissue. We finished the surgery in just over an hour. As we stripped from our surgical gear, Mickey gave me a wink.
"Nice work, Dr. Hill."
I removed my surgical hat as I entered the waiting room, where Trina Crouch sat, looking worn and tired.
"She did great," I said. "I'm very optimistic she'll recover full vision."
Crouch burst into tears. After a moment, she took my hand.
"Thank you," she said. "I don't know what to say. I wish you would let me pay you something."
"That isn't necessary," I said. Mickey and I had donated our time, and the hospital administrator at Mercy cut the costs of the operating room and the instruments as much as she could. Trina pulled an envelope from her purse.
"It's a thank you card for the person who paid the hospital bill."
I told Trina that Daniela's benefactor wished to remain anonymous.
"I'll be certain he gets it," I said.
Ernie had insisted on paying. He'd helped his father grow Cantwell Computers exponentially, and he had become a wealthy man in the process. He said there were new opportunities on the horizon, something about a new platform that would allow people to view pages on a computer like pages in a book, one hidden behind the other, as well as other technology that would someday allow us to send information from computers on our desks to other computers around the world. To me, it continued to sound like a Star Trek fantasy, but then I'd never thought I'd be able to put a phone in my car either.
"Would you like to see her?" I asked. "She's coming out of sedation, so she'll be groggy, but I think she'll feel better having her mommy in the room."
When Trina stepped into the recovery room, Daniela's head was swathed in bandages and her eye was covered with a protective cup and gauze. It was heartless of me, I knew, but it was an image I wanted burned into Trina Crouch's own retina so that it would hopefully never again come to fruition. She held Daniela's hand and kissed the bandages around her forehead. There was not a dry eye in the room. Late that afternoon, Trina sat in a chair in Daniela's room, sipping a Diet Coke, and we talked while Daniela slept. Trina looked at me and said the words I needed to hear.
"I'm ready to end this. I don't ever want to see my daughter like this again."
9. Concerned David Bateman was stalking his ex-wife, I arranged for a meeting at my office to make it appear to be a normal follow-up. Mickey and Dr. Pat LeBaron, the emergency room doctor who had initially treated Daniela, sat in the conference room along with Marilee Montoya from the San Mateo County Department of Justice's Domestic Violence Unit. Ernie's father had arranged for her to be present. Montoya was a petite Hispanic woman with gray hair, the gravelly voice of a smoker, and a no-nonsense demeanor. Once seated, I began by expressing my suspicion.
"The medical evidence, in my opinion, does not comport with a blow to the head from a bike accident," I said. "The incidents of detached retinas in children this young are rare."
"But it does happen," Montoya asked.
"In rare incidents. But the emergency room injuries also do not substantiate that Daniela fell from her bike."
"Which were what?" Montoya asked.
LeBaron passed out her emergency room report. "Minor scratches, some healed. I would have expected far more than a scrape on the knee if Daniela sustained a blow to the head of sufficient force to cause this type of injury."
"But you can't say definitively that he hit her," Montoya said.
"No," LeBaron and I said in unison. Montoya's brow furrowed. Trina,
who had largely kept her gaze on the conference room table, raised her eyes.
Daniela can, she said.
This caught everyone's attention. A tear trickled from the corner of Trina's eye, and I again became concerned she might back out. But the floodgates opened, and the words came in a rush. She says her daddy hits her. After a moment for Trina to compose herself, Montoya said,
But you've never reported any prior instance of abuse, is that correct?
Would you have? Mickey asked. Montoya raised a hand.
I'm not judging. I'm just saying, I know what you're saying,
and I know what you're not saying, Mickey said. Everyone in the room knows it. Her husband's a psychopath, and he's a cop. Who is she going to report it to?
He'll deny it, Montoya said.
Don't they all? Mickey asked.
It makes a more difficult case, and these cases can be difficult enough as it is. Without corroborating contemporaneous evidence, it's her word against his, Montoya said,
and I began to understand why child abuse cases were so difficult to prosecute.
I kept a journal, Trina said.
Montoya sat up.
What type of journal?
A calendar. I wrote the days Daniela visited her father and the injury she came home with. There was also an incident in which she broke her arm. He said she fell from a swing at the playground, but Daniela said he never took her to the playground. I took her to the hospital. There's a report, the Baron said. I saw it in the file.
Where's this calendar? Montoya asked.
Trina pulled two black day planners from a bag at the side of her chair. The pages appeared to be well-worn.
How far do these date back?
Montoya asked, flipping through the pages. 14 months, Trina said, crying again. Since I divorced him. He started becoming more unstable. He'd always been volatile, but he got worse. He started drinking, and things deteriorated from there. Montoya lifted her head from reading one of the entries.
Why didn't you say anything earlier?
Trina dabbed at her eyes with Kleenex.
It's like Dr. Kennedy said.
Who was I going to tell?
David constantly threatened us,
and Daniela wouldn't talk about what happened when she stayed with him. I don't know what he said to her, but whatever he'd said frightened her. I brought it up with him once when Daniela came home with a bruise on her arm. David said he'd already filed a report that Daniela came to his house with the injury, and that if I opened my mouth, he'd take her from me. He said, who did I think the police would believe? I was afraid for my daughter, afraid to make him angry.
Can we go through some of these?
Montoya said, indicating the calendar entries.
I'd like to hear what the doctors have to say.
Trina went through her calendar. Dr. LeBaron did most of the commenting on the nature of the injuries and whether they were consistent with the reported manner in which they had occurred. As Trina revealed months of abuse at the hands of her husband, Mickey and I sat silent.
He's been stalking you, Montoya said at one point.
No doubt, I said, and told of my nighttime confrontation with Bateman in the parking lot of the Presbyterian Church.
What's his attitude now? Is he asking to see Daniela?
Montoya asked.
No,
Trina said. I told Trina to tell David that I recommended Daniela remain in a familiar environment, that any fall of any kind could cause the retina to detach, I said.
And he hasn't fought you on it?
Montoya asked. Trina shook her head. Not yet.
But it's a matter of time. He uses Daniela to try to hurt me.
I called him on the abuse at my meeting with him, I said. It might have scared him enough to back off, but it won't keep him at bay forever. Trina says he has a real bulldog for an attorney.
Alexander Chekhov, Montoya said.
I knew the name from billboards and radio commercials. She addressed Trina.
Your husband has a court order giving him visiting rights. He'll move to enforce it. We'll need to file a temporary restraining order and seek a permanent injunction to keep him away from you and your daughter until we can get you full custody.
Montoya looked to me and LeBaron.
I'll need declarations.
The conversation turned to how to best keep Trina and Daniela safe while the court process played out.
Is there some place you can go?
Montoya asked.
I have a sister who lives in Tucson.
How much time do you need? I asked Montoya.
No way to know for certain.
What if I write up a report recommending that Daniela go someplace warm to facilitate her recovery? I can say that the dry weather would be better for her recuperation. Trina's attorney could give it to David's attorney, if he makes a stink.
It would buy us some time, Montoya agreed. Give you a chance to get out of town before we serve him with the papers.
Trina nodded.
What about you?
Montoya asked, looking at me.
What about me? He's come after you once. He could come again.
If he does, he does, I said. I was done being afraid of David Bateman. As the meeting concluded, I felt better with a plan in place, but I also couldn't help but think of something I'd heard a young heavyweight boxer named Mike Tyson once say. Tyson had risen to sudden stardom with his ferocious boxing style. When asked why he never deviated from his attack, no matter the opponent, Tyson replied, "Everyone has a plan, until they get punched in the mouth." 10. 2 weeks passed without incident, though I felt as though I was walking barefoot over broken glass. Trina Crouch brought Daniela in for visits, and Montoya used the opportunities to come into the office and get the legal papers prepared to secure a TRO, which would accuse David Bateman of child abuse. We were waiting until Daniela was capable of travel. When I deemed her fit, Trina loaded up the car in the middle of the night and drove to Tucson. She did not want a paper trail with an airline ticket. During that time, David's attorney had never called, nor did David. Montoya called me at the office late on a Wednesday afternoon, a few days after Trina left town.
Okay, she said. The papers are filed, and he's been served. Keep alert.
When's the hearing?
6 days, though I expect his attorney will ask for a continuance to get competing declarations.
Will it work?
Not unless he can find a doctor to counter your declaration and Dr. LeBaron's. The evidence is strong.
I stayed late to finish paperwork and left my office as the sun was beginning to set and dusk descended over Burlingame. Mickey had left 3 hours earlier for her yoga class. Paperwork had never been her thing. As I walked down the sidewalk to the parking lot at the back of the building, a patrol car drove alongside of me. David Bateman sat in the passenger seat with the window down. I stopped, as did the patrol car. For a second, I thought Bateman would get out and confront me. He looked as angry as the kid who had become a raging bull the day he had pummeled me at the park, nostrils flaring, eyes blazing. He made a gun with his thumb and index finger, and mimed pulling the trigger. I drove home, conscious of the speed limit. 3 blocks from my house, the police car reappeared behind me. I made a right turn. The car followed. I made another left, careful to stay on heavily trafficked roads and to drive the speed limit. The car stayed with me. Not wanting to drive home, I drove down Cabrillo and saw many cars parked at the OLM parking lot and others still arriving. Bingo night. I pulled in. The patrol car drove past and continued down the street. I had to take a few deep breaths before I pulled from the lot and drove home. When I arrived, I poured myself a drink and took a sip. The phone rang. Hello? No one answered. Hello? I said again.
You're going to lose, Bateman said, and so is she.
Who is this? I said, but I knew exactly who it was.
You know who it is. Be careful out driving late. You won't want to get pulled over again.
I'm recording this conversation, I said. Go ahead, David. Just keep talking. Bateman hung up. The phone immediately rang again. I contemplated not answering. Then I had a thought and picked it up. Time to grow up, David. You touch me again and I'll have you arrested. Then I'll sue you and take everything you own.
Sam?
Mickey.
Sorry.
What was...
Shit! He called you, didn't he?
I told her about the drive-by. I'm coming over. You don't need... But Mickey had already hung up. She arrived at my house 10 minutes later, still dressed in her yoga outfit. She'd brought Bandit with her. I'm leaving him here with you. You're making too big a deal out of this. If Bateman had wanted to do something, he could have tried. He's just a bully. In truth, I was beginning to realize how unstable David Bateman was, and I was grateful to have Bandit. He already did do something, or don't you remember? She reached into her purse and pulled out a handgun. I knew Mickey had owned a gun since her mid-20s, when she'd been attacked on the UC Davis campus while attending medical school. She'd managed to get away, but the attack had unnerved her, and she told me that she never wanted to feel that helpless again. She took self-defense classes and shooting lessons and obtained a concealed weapon permit. Mickey, I'm not going to use a gun, I said, conscious of those articles about people who owned a gun to protect themselves, having the same gun turned on them. She placed it on the counter, along with a box of bullets. Most people who own a gun never have to use it. It's the threat of the gun that deters the need. Just keep it with you in the house. It will make me feel better. Fine. I'll keep it here, but I'm not going to use it. I hope you don't, she said. 11. Over the next 5 days, the practice kept me busy during the day, and I brought paperwork home with me so I wasn't at the office late. Mickey made a point of coming over for dinner a couple of nights, and she'd called Ernie and asked that he check in with me daily by phone. You're not doing any wonders for my manhood, I said one night over dinner. I don't care, she said. Besides, I said, I got the big boy here to watch over me. Bandit had become my most faithful companion, never leaving my side and sleeping in his dog basket in my bedroom. He's never going to leave you now, Mickey said. You spoil him. Then I guess you'll just have to move in, I said. She didn't respond. On the sixth day, Montoya called with the news she'd predicted. Bateman's lawyer had obtained a continuance of the TRO hearing. In return, David had to agree to stay away from his daughter and his ex-wife until the matter was heard the following week. But that didn't happen either. The court again delayed the hearing when the judge got reassigned to handle a murder trial. All of this was incredibly frustrating and nerve-wracking for Trina and for me. Trina would get mentally geared up to fly back for the hearing, only to be told that it had been put off, or she had to wait and worry for another week. I didn't have to make those kinds of arrangements, but I had to keep my schedule open. Bateman's lawyer had subpoenaed both me and Dr. LeBaron to the hearing. Apparently, he intended to cross-examine us. There was little doubt in my mind that Bateman and his attorney were delaying the proceedings on purpose, just to screw with his ex-wife, and maybe with me. When the hearing was set a third time, Montoya told me she'd call only if the hearing was put over. Another week passed. The night before the rescheduled hearing, Trina Crouch called me to advise that she'd flown home and was staying in a hotel. She was nervous, her voice quavering, and seeking reassurance. I'll be there, I said. So will Dr. LeBaron. And Montoya is confident the TRO will be granted and the judge will make it permanent. They didn't file any doctor's affidavits to counter our opinions. David's attorney can cross-examine us all he wants. He can't win. David can't win this time, Trina. He can't. A part of me was saying this just to calm her, but a part of me truly believed David Bateman could not win, not without some competing doctor's declaration. I awoke at 6 the following morning after a fitful night tossing and turning. I gathered the newspaper from the driveway, my gaze drifting up and down the block, looking for a patrol car or a suspicious car I did not recognize. The hearing was set for 10 a.m. I spent the next 2 hours reading the paper, drinking coffee, and generally trying to keep myself occupied. At 8 a.m., I jumped in the shower. As I turned off the water, I heard my phone ringing, wrapped the towel around my waist, and answered the extension in the bedroom. Dr. Hill, it's Marilee Montoya. My heart sank. Please tell me they are not continuing the hearing again. What is wrong with our legal system? He's manipulating everyone just to cause his ex-wife emotional distress. She's a wreck. How can this keep happening?
The hearing isn't continued, Montoya said.
I didn't sense the same strength and confidence I usually heard in her voice. I sensed something different, something unnerving. Montoya sounded defeated.
What do you mean?
She's dead,
Montoya said softly. I felt the floor fall out from under my feet, and my legs buckled. I stumbled to the bed so I didn't fall.
We had a meeting scheduled at 7:30 to go over everything. When Trina didn't show up, and I couldn't raise her on her telephone, I sent a patrol by the hotel where she was staying.
Montoya paused to gather herself. She was, or had been, crying.
He shot her. Then he shot himself.
12. David Bateman's murder of his ex-wife and subsequent suicide made headlines in San Mateo County. I did not sleep that night, nor much that week. I feared going to bed and closing my eyes. David Bateman came every night, haunting me, taunting me. Trina and Daniela called out to me, pleaded with me, telling me that I had assured them no harm would come to them. My insomnia stretched to months. When I did sleep, it was with the aid of a pill, but even that did not prevent the nightmares. David Bateman shooting Trina Crouch, silver flashes blinding me, the thunder of the gun causing a ringing white noise in my ears that did not abate after I awoke. The persistent ringing prevented me from concentrating at work. I missed appointments. Mickey covered for me. I lost my train of thought in the middle of sentences. Large chunks of my day seemed to vanish, unaccounted for. My inability to sleep brought fatigue, which brought lethargy and a darkness I had never known. At Mickey's suggestion, I consulted Dr. Pridemore, who put me in contact with one of his colleagues at the Stanford Medical School. The diagnosis was post-traumatic stress disorder, the illness so many young men brought home from the jungles of Vietnam. The doctor recommended therapy, which only confirmed what I had already concluded. I blamed myself for Trina Crouch's death. I had been the one pushing her to stand up to her husband, and I couldn't dismiss the thought that I had used her to do what I had been unable to do, to fight the bully. My counselor explained to me why that wasn't the case. He told me that I, too, had been willing to stand up to David Bateman in court. He reasoned that even if I hadn't, Trina still might very well be dead. He explained that David Bateman was a psychopath, so damaged as a child as to be beyond repair. It was all very rational and pragmatic, but it did not change the fact that Trina Crouch was dead, and Daniela would be raised by an aunt in Tucson without her mother or her father. It did nothing to cure my insomnia or my nightmares or to make me feel any less guilty. Now, more than ever, David Bateman's face and voice haunted me. It was as it had been in grammar school. His specter, ever present. Mickey suggested more counseling, but I had grown tired of people asking me how I felt and what I wanted. What did I want? I wanted to understand. I wanted to believe what every person on the planet wants to believe, that God had a plan for me, and that God's will was not just a parent's answer to silence a child who asked too many questions. I also knew I would not find that answer in Burlingame. I cannot say I left Burlingame in search of answers. That would be a lie. At that moment, I was not searching for anything. I was running. I was running from Trina's death, running from the memory of David Bateman, and running from a faith that seemed to solve every problem, not with a solution, but with an excuse. It's God's will. Part 7. Saying Goodbyes. 1. April, 1999, Costa Rica. 9 in the morning, and I was already pursuing.